Let's turn to 2 Chronicles chapter 29. Last week we looked at the conclusion of the reign of Ahaz, and it was not a happy sight. But this week we see the amazing grace of God to provide a king like Hezekiah, and the people who are, as we'll see at the end of the chapter, prepared by God for the work which is done. 2 Chronicles chapter 29. Hezekiah became king when he was 25 years old, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Abijah, the daughter of Zechariah. And he did what was right in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his father David had done. In the first year of his reign, in the first month, he opened the doors of the house of the Lord and repaired them. Then he brought in the priests and the Levites and gathered them in the east square and said to them, "Hear me, Levites, now sanctify yourselves. Sanctify the house of the Lord God of your fathers, and carry out the rubbish from the holy place. For our fathers have trespassed and done evil in the eyes of the Lord our God. They have forsaken him, and turned their backs away from the dwelling place of the Lord, and turned their backs on him. They have also shut up the doors of the vestibule, put out the lamps, and have not burned incense or offered burnt offerings in the holy place to the God of Israel. Therefore the wrath of the Lord fell upon Judah and Jerusalem, and he has given them up to trouble, to desolation, and to jeering, as you see with your eyes. For indeed, because of this, our fathers have fallen by the sword, and our sons, our daughters, and our wives are in captivity. Now it is in my heart to make a covenant with the Lord God of Israel, that his fierce wrath may turn away from us. My sons, do not be negligent now, for the Lord has chosen you to stand before him, to serve him, and that you should minister to him and burn incense." Then these Levites arose, Mahath the son of Amasai, and Joel the son of Azariah, of the sons of the Kohathites, of the sons of Merari, Kish the son of Abdi, and Azariah the son of Jehalalel, of the Gershonites, Joah the son of Zimmah, and Eden the son of Joah, of the sons of Elizaphan, Shimri and Jael, of the sons of Asaph, Zechariah and Mattaniah, of the sons of Heman, Jehiel and Shimei, of the sons of Jeduthun, Shemaiah and Uziel. And they gathered their brethren, sanctified themselves, and went, according to the commandment of the king, at the words of the Lord, to cleanse the house of the Lord. Then the priests went into the inner part of the house of the Lord to cleanse it, and brought out all the debris that they found in the temple of the Lord, to the court of the house of the Lord. And the Levites took it out and carried it to the brook Kidron. Now they began to sanctify on the first day of the first month, and on the eighth day of the month they came to the vestibule of the Lord. So they sanctified the house of the Lord in 8 days. And on the 16th day of the first month they finished. Then they went in to King Hezekiah and said, "We have cleansed all the house of the Lord, the altar of burnt offerings with all its articles, and the table of the showbread with all its articles. Moreover, all the articles which King Ahaz in his reign had cast aside in his transgression, we have prepared and sanctified. And there they are before the altar of the Lord." Then King Hezekiah rose early, gathered the rulers of the city, and went up to the house of the Lord. And they brought 7 bulls, 7 rams, 7 lambs, and 7 male goats for a sin offering for the kingdom, for the sanctuary, and for Judah. Then he commanded the priests, the sons of Aaron, to offer them on the altar of the Lord. So they killed the bulls, and the priests received the blood and sprinkled it on the altar. Likewise they killed the rams and sprinkled the blood on the altar. They also killed the lambs and sprinkled the blood on the altar. Then they brought out the male goats for the sin offering before the king and the assembly, and they laid their hands on them. And the priests killed them. And they presented their blood on the altar as a sin offering to make an atonement for all Israel. For the king commanded that the burnt offering and the sin offering be made for all Israel. And he stationed the Levites in the house of the Lord with cymbals, with stringed instruments, and with harps, according to the commandment of David, of Gad the king's seer, and of Nathan the prophet. For thus was the commandment of the Lord by his prophets. Then the Levites stood with the instruments of David, and the priests with the trumpets. Then Hezekiah commanded them to offer the burnt offering on the altar. And when the burnt offering began, the song of the Lord also began. with the trumpets and with the instruments of David, king of Israel. So all the assembly worshipped, the singers sang, and the trumpeters sounded. All this continued until the burnt offering was finished. And when they had finished offering, the king and all who were present with him bowed and worshipped. Moreover, King Hezekiah and the leaders commanded the Levites to sing praise to the Lord with the words of David and of Asaph the seer. So they sang praises with gladness, and they bowed their heads and worshipped. Then Hezekiah answered and said, "Now that you have consecrated yourselves to the Lord, come near and bring sacrifices and thank offerings into the house of the Lord." So the assembly brought in sacrifices and thank offerings, and as many as were of a willing heart brought burnt offerings. And the number of the burnt offerings which the assembly brought was 70 bulls, 100 rams, and 200 lambs. All these were for a burnt offering to the Lord. The consecrated things were 600 bulls and 3,000 sheep. But the priests were too few, so that they could not skin all the burnt offerings. Therefore their brethren, the Levites, helped them until the work was ended, and until the other priests had sanctified themselves. For the Levites were more diligent in sanctifying themselves than the priests. Also the burnt offerings were in abundance, with the fat of the peace offerings and with the drink offerings for every burnt offering. So the service of the house of the Lord was set in order. Then Hezekiah and all the people rejoiced that God had prepared the people, since the events took place so suddenly. Now this chapter is the first of four chapters which talk about the reign of Hezekiah. This is the longest treatment that any of the kings after David and Solomon receive, and it's uniformly positive, at least until we come to the time of the until the last of those chapters, where there are other factors that enter in. But the summary given in verse 2 is probably a good characterization, at least for quite a while, of what we see in Hezekiah. He did what was right in the sight of the Lord according to all that his father David had done. This is something I guess we reflected on last week a little bit, but it's amazing that this one of the best of the kings should come from one of the worst of the kings. He was the son of Ahaz, who was extremely unfaithful and given over to wickedness, who served all the gods he could find, or at least so it seemed. And Hezekiah, in an amazing turnaround from his father, overthrows really everything his father worked for, and instead restores the true religion and the true worship of God. Now, just a couple of background comments. First of all, there probably, as we've seen in the past, there probably was some sort of a co-regency, an overlap between Hezekiah and Ahaz. And it could be that, in fact, the reforms that are described here took place before Ahaz actually died, that Hezekiah somehow taken authority from his father. There are different questions that come up, and a lot of technicalities about how old Ahaz was when Hezekiah was born and so forth. I don't really want to go into the details of that, but it's you should keep in mind when people, you know, approach you about trying to line up all the dates of the kings, that co-regencies are mentioned fairly frequently and are probably a solution to many of the questions that come up about lining up the dates. The other comment I would make is just that the parallel passage in Kings is quite different in terms of the emphasis. If you think of what you know about the reign of Hezekiah, you probably think about what you read in the book of Kings and in Isaiah, where there's an emphasis on the invasion of Sennacherib. Remember that tremendous account where the army surrounds the city, and the leader of the army, the so-called Rabshakeh, comes up and mocks the Jews, and then they wake up one morning and the enemy camped around is dead. 185,000 of them were killed. But that's that. Those military aspects of Hezekiah's faithfulness are thrown into the fore in the book of Kings, but they come at the end here. And the book of Kings only spends a few verses talking about the religious reform. I think I won't read those verses, but it's 2 Kings 18, 1 through 6, talks about the religious reforms that Hezekiah worked at the beginning, and then goes on to talk about the military aspects. Here, the chronicler brings in much more detail about the reform of worship, although, interestingly enough, he doesn't mention the one kind of unusual event in the reign of Hezekiah, which was this bronze serpent. Remember, there was, in the time of Moses, this bronze serpent which had been given for healing, that they could look to it and be saved, in the sense of physical deliverance from the what was striking them down. Well, apparently by the time of Hezekiah, this had become an object of worship, and so Hezekiah took it and destroyed it. So that's one interesting thing that's mentioned in the parallel account in Kings. But it is a noteworthy thing that the first thing that Hezekiah does, and you can see there's a certain emphasis on this, in the first year of his reign, what is it that he sets about to do? Well, now you can ask, what would you do if you were in his place? Your father has just sold you out to the Assyrians. You're under their domination, and you're finding yourself more and more in their stranglehold. He's in a very difficult situation politically and militarily. But the first thing he does is to reform the worship of God. It's a striking thing if you think about it. And the writer places a certain emphasis on that. And I thought I would read the Geneva Bible, not the new Geneva Study Bible notes, but the Geneva Bible note on from the 16th century commenting on this. They're commenting specifically on verse 3 of chapter 29, but that's the same point. Now, the note is, this is a notable example for all princes, first to establish the pure religion of God and to procure that the Lord may be honored and served correctly. And if I may add, it's not only a notable example for all princes, but also for all church leaders and for all the people to have in mind the love of God's name and to see him honored. There are other pressing concerns, and Hezekiah does deal with the military problem that does come up later on, but the first thing that he does is seek to reform the worship. And the other comment I would make at the beginning is that this took place in an amazingly short amount of time. You notice the reference to the 16 days, so it took less than 3 weeks to overthrow all that his father had worked for. Now, normally fathers don't like to see their sons overthrowing everything that they worked for, but this was a good thing that he did in a very short amount of time. And that's why that last verse of the chapter is such a striking way. That's, the emphasis at the end of the account is that all the people rejoice, and they rejoice because the work had been done so suddenly. And how was it that this could take place so suddenly? Well, verse 36 says that God prepared the people. It was the work of God to stir up the hearts of the people. Of course, not only, you might say, the common people, but including Hezekiah and the religious leaders, to do this complete about-face and to seek to restore the worship of God. That was the work of God. God prepared their hearts. He brought things about so that this could happen. There's a certain emphasis on the divine sovereignty and on the work of his Spirit in particular to bring about this amazing reformation. Any comments or questions? Introductory part? Okay. Well, let's look at the some of the details. I actually don't expect that I'm going to finish the whole chapter because it's fairly long, but I'd like to see how far we can get. The verses that follow the immediate introduction are verses 4 through 11. That's the first section. And in that section, there's an exhortation that is given by Hezekiah. Hezekiah gathers together the priests and the Levites in this place near the temple and gives them an exhortation. Now, you know, our first reaction would be, well, what place does the king have to do this kind of thing? Why is it that the king is calling them to this, to do this? What authority does he have? And I think the chronicler takes certain pains to make it clear that the king is just telling them what God had already told them to do. In other words, the king isn't telling them anything new. He is calling them to do their duty. And that receives a certain prominence in this. You may have noticed that as I read through, he first of all, and we'll see some more of this as we go through it, but in his exhortation, he uses the language of the of the book of Deuteronomy in particular, but of the law of Moses generally, to warn them of that the judgment that was coming on the nation was because of the sinfulness of their rejection of God's worship. So in other words, he's setting it in the context of God's law and not just his arbitrary decision like, hey, you know, whatever suits you. My dad liked the foreign gods. I like our God. You know, let's just go this way for a while. That's not the point at all, right? It's not my personal preference. Personal preference being the chief god in our day, America anyway, it seems like. That's the final appeal, whatever I like. But that wasn't the way it was with Hezekiah. He's exhorting them based on God's law, and that's the language that's used here in verses 1 through 4 through 11. Then if I could just try to trace that theme somewhat through the chapter, notice in verse 15, when they actually do it, it says they went according to the commandment of the king, okay, but it doesn't stop there, at the words of the Lord. So you see, there's the emphasis again that it's not just the king's command, it's the words of the Lord that are behind the king's command. And I missed, I guess, actually another reference along these lines in verse 11. Do not be negligent now, for the Lord has chosen you to stand before him. In other words, the emphasis in verse 11 is that he's calling them to do the duty that God committed to them. In other words, he's just telling them to do their job, as it were, but it's the divinely appointed job. And that of course, flows throughout, even at the time of the sacrifice, and if we get that far. You can see in verse 25 what was done, it says, at the end of verse 25, thus was the commandment of the Lord by his prophets. Okay, so you shouldn't miss the point that all the reformation that took place was not the reformation according to the personal preferences of King Hezekiah, but according to the commandment of the Lord. He was restoring the worship that God had commanded. Okay, so maybe you're tired of hearing me say that. That's kind of that's the theme that comes out. Whenever there's a faithful restoration of worship, it's emphasized that it's according to God's commandment. And that's an important point. Along with that, I should emphasize also the fact that there's a tremendous rejoicing. So he not only exhorts them in verses 4 through 11 to do their duty, but he calls them really in anticipation of great blessing. I guess you could say that's implied in this section, verses 4 through 11, because if there were curses of the covenant that came on unfaithfulness, when they turned to that portion of their Bibles, then they would realize there are also blessings that came on faithfulness. And I think you would have noticed that as I read, especially at the end, there's an emphasis on rejoicing. In verse... now it's escaped me. I thought it was in verse 28. Oh, verse 30. Sorry. So they sang praises with gladness, and they bowed their heads and worshipped. And then verse 36 at the end, as we already read, the people rejoice that God had prepared the people. So not only is there an emphasis on worshiping God according to his will, but there's also an emphasis on the rejoicing that accompanies that, and the joy that follows, that accompanies true worship. So I wanted to set out those themes at the beginning. I think they're implicit in verses 4 through 11. And it's kind of easy to lose the forest for the trees, if that's the right phrase. When we look at all the details of what's going on here, right? I mean, it doesn't really seem to be too appropriate to us. We don't have too unclean a room in which we worship or which we study, right? It's kind of hard to relate to cleansing the temple, to all these animal sacrifices and so forth. You know, it's kind of hard to relate to all that. But the underlying principle, I think, is made plain enough, and that is that God has set forth the way he is to be worshipped, and that is not a dull and a dreary thing, but a thing of rejoicing. So if you could keep that in mind as we go through some of the details, I think that will be helpful. But maybe I should pause and see. You see what I'm talking about? Any comments or questions? We're a quiet group this morning. Maybe it's because you have comfortable chairs to sit in. Or maybe they're very uncomfortable. I don't know. I'm not sitting in one of them. All right, anyway, let's look in a little bit more detail at verses 4 through 11. As I said, this is Hezekiah exhorting them to do what God has already commanded them to do. And he acknowledges, well, first of all, he says in verse 5, that they have to sanctify themselves. Before they can sanctify the temple, that is by getting rid of the defilement, particularly the defilement connected with his father Ahaz, They have to sanctify themselves. Now there is, of course, a ritual defilement, which was very much a part of the Old Testament ceremonial system. And just the fact that God's worship had been so corrupted would lead you to expect that the priest would be defiled already. But I think it probably goes beyond that to just the regular defilement, which a man could defile himself with, whatever the right way of saying that is. And so he's calling them first to set themselves apart, and then to go about the cleansing of the temple and the worship. And again, I think, although this is maybe a little bit of allegorizing, there is a principle here that if we would seek to reform the worship of God, then we ourselves must set ourselves apart. That is, there is a preparation of the heart and a dedication which goes in before we can seek to bring about a larger reformation. Verses 6 and following are very interesting because, as I mentioned before, he draws on the language of the Mosaic Law. And I noted in particular reference to Deuteronomy chapter 28, which I think we'll not take time to look at, but that's one of the catalogs of cursings and blessings. And in particular, the language that's used here of their going into exile and the mockery that they have fallen into in verses 8 and 9. The Lord has given them up to trouble, to desolation, to jeering. Our fathers have fallen by the sword. Our sons, our daughters have gone into captivity. This is a reference, certainly, to things that took place even under his father's reign. And we read about the captivities, not only under the northern kingdom, but also under Syria, what they experienced. So he's really saying that God's wrath has come on us just as God had said in his word it would. But the way in which he described that sin in verses 6 and 7 is helpful. Again, it's drawing on a common theme in the law and in Chronicles also. There's an emphasis on the fact that they have forsaken him. And even the picturesque way of saying it, they've turned their faces away from the dwelling place of the Lord. Now, that was literally true because, remember, Ahaz had set up a separate altar, so he wouldn't be facing toward the Lord in service of him. In fact, they may have, you know, their orientation of worship may have been different. But I think the special emphasis is the spiritual aspect, that they turn their backs on God. And that it's all too often the temptation of even the believer to turn his back on God and to seek after other things which cannot be fruitful ultimately. But it says they've turned their faces away from the dwelling place of the Lord and turned their backs on him. And then the details that are given in verse 7 are the things that we already saw under Ahaz. That is, they shut up the doors of the vestibule. They raided the temple for the things they needed for their idol worship. Those things are described in verse 7. And that's part of the point of the restoration, is just to bring those things back. So he sets out the context, that is, that the whole nation is under God's judgment because of their unfaithfulness to him. But he doesn't set it out in a way which leads to hopelessness. Instead, he says there is a way back. And that's the beautiful thing about God's law in the book of Deuteronomy. It's far from having just the negative aspect, like, you know, God is just going to destroy you because he hates you. That's not it at all. There's a covenant relationship. If you stray from the covenant, God in his mercy will chastise you. And in that chastisement, then, you're called to turn back to God. And that's what he's doing here. And it's exactly what Solomon prayed for in his dedication of the temple. And so that brings us to verses 10 and 11. He says, "It is in my heart to make a covenant with the Lord God of Israel." Now, as I read it, this is then the context in which we should understand the rest of the chapter, that it is another one of these covenant renewals, of which there are four described in the book of Chronicles. And it, especially as a covenant renewal, focuses on the king's renewal of worship to God, but also on the rededication of the temple. And so this covenant renewal focuses attention really back on what Solomon did. And you may have noticed as we read through this how much of this reminds you of what happened in Solomon's time and the dedication of the temple and the emphasis on all the sacrifices that were brought and the language that's used to to call the people to worship him. So he says it is his desire to make this covenant. And again, in verse 10, the purpose is that God's fierce wrath may turn away from us. And so he exhorts them, as I already mentioned earlier in verse 11, he exhorts them based on their calling. God has chosen you for this task. Now do it. That's what he's saying. If you put it in short, it's a beautiful message where he weaves together both their own experience under their father and their current experience. He weaves that in with the law of God. But in the end, there's the exhortation as there was at the beginning. Now go do it. Right? You should go forth and work the restoration which you've been called to. So that's the exhortation that he gives, and I think it's important to, as we think through this chapter, to realize that Hezekiah here really becomes a type of Christ, as Christ sought to cleanse the temple, of course, the physical building in his own day, to clear the court of the Gentiles, and ultimately in his work on the cross to purify for himself a people to be his very own, zealous for good works, as Paul writes to Titus. So we should see Hezekiah here as a little picture of our great Lord, whose zeal for the Lord's house consumed him. Any comments on down to verse 11? Maybe we need different chairs in this room. Okay, well, moving right along then. There's the list of in verse 12 of the reformers, and in fact, Trapp in his commentary sort of compares this to the list of the, you know, what we might say in the Protestant Reformation, who the great reformers were. These were men. Interestingly enough, these are Levites who are listed, not priests necessarily. Levites, one from each of the major families, and it includes the musical Levites, the ones who were chosen out especially for the ministry of music. These men are listed, I think, specifically to honor them, that they set themselves apart and they answered to the call. Not all of them did, or at least not all of them were very diligent in doing so. You noticed at the end of the chapter there weren't enough priests because they hadn't been as diligent as the Levites in setting themselves apart. So these were the guys in the front line who were overthrowing what the system had been under Ahaz. Apparently, at least from Kings, it looks like the priest was willing enough to listen to the king to introduce idolatry. It's not clear exactly how thoroughly that affected all the Levites, but these men were willing to do the work of reformation. So the verses follow then and describe, and I don't think I'll look at this in any detail, but verses 14 and following, well, the list stops at the end of verse 14. 15 and following describe what they do. They sanctify themselves just as the king told them to do. They made themselves ceremonially clean for the work, and then they did what the king had told them, because it was, after all, God's commandment, and they cleansed the house of the Lord. So the priests, who have the sort of the right of access to certain parts of the temple, bring the things out to the outer courts and as it's called, the debris here in the New King James Version, and then the Levites take that out to Kidron, the book Kidron, which, as we saw under, I think it was Asa, that was the place where they dumped the monuments of idolatry before. The Kidron, that area, was also a graveyard, so an appropriate place for unclean things, like what they were taking out of the temple. And so verses 17 and following describe then the sort of the timeline and the conclusion. They began to sanctify on the first day of the first month. On the eighth day of the month, they got this far, and then by the 16th day, they were finished, and they reported back to Hezekiah what had happened. And they restored everything that needed to be restored, even what Ahaz had removed. That's described in verses 18 and 19. So that's the account of the cleansing from idolatry. And then there's a need for a restoration of the worship. After having removed negative aspects and brought back into place everything that should be there. Verses 20 and following describe then the great rededication of the temple to the worship of God. Now, I think it's really hard for us to understand what an event this would have been. If you can imagine having, as a faithful worshiper of the Lord, having to suffer under Ahaz and to see the house of God desecrated, to come to this joyous time where they have this tremendous gathering. And there's an emphasis on the zeal that they have in verse 20. Hezekiah rose early. Now, I'm not particularly fond of rising early, but often in the scriptures this is emphasized as a point to show a determination to do God's work. Remember Abraham, after he was told to sacrifice his son, it says he rose up early in the morning. If you're going to have to do it, if you're determined to do it, then I suppose you could say you might as well get up early. But that's the emphasis here, and the determination fits in with the rest of the chapter. Hezekiah rose early. He gathers, you might say, the constituencies. There's an emphasis on representation not only of the, in the civil realm, but also in the ecclesiastical realm, that is the priests and the Levites and in the people. And that then goes and follows, following on that then is a description of the sacrifices. Now, I thought about going into some of the details of this, but I thought in the end that maybe I'll just leave it to you to look up some of the references. Excuse me. Leviticus chapter 1 is a good place to start for some of the details of what's going on here. But there are different kinds of sacrifices, right? There are these whole burnt offerings, and there are these fellowship offerings. And there were the animals that were offered were treated in different ways depending on the purpose. There's an emphasis here especially on the sin offering at the beginning. See verse 21. They brought these animals as a sin offering, and there's a threefold purpose for the kingdom, which probably has especially to do with the king and his house, that is, you might say, for the civil sphere. For the sanctuary, having to do with that part of that realm, that sphere of authority, and then for the nation as a whole, for Judah. All, of course, had been involved in the guilt of the idolatry, and for each of those three, then, there was an offering made. And again, I'll try to avoid some of the details, but I want to point out the emphasis. The blood is sprinkled on the altar. They repeat the details of this, I think, to emphasize that this is done according to the commandment that God had given to Moses. And notice in particular verse 23 that in bringing these offerings out, they laid their hands on them. Now, that took place especially, I think, you'd be familiar with in the Day of Atonement, when there was the goat that had to be sent out into the wilderness, as well as one that was sacrificed. But also in Leviticus chapter 1, there is a laying on of hands. And it's such a beautiful picture of the fact that these animal sacrifices were intended to show that without the shedding of blood, there is no remission of sins, and that the animals were not dying for their own sins, that's obvious enough, but that they were dying for the sin of the sacrificer, of the one who offered them up. And of course, that's what the writer to the Hebrews takes up so beautifully in his letter, and emphasizes the fact that these could only be a foreshadowing of the true sacrifice, who is Christ. It's as we are in him, as we are his people, that we enjoy the benefit of his redemption. That he is the one who is the ultimate sin offering. This guilt, which is ours, truly ours, is transferred to him, just as the hands were laid on the sin offering. And that's, I think this chapter sets out very beautifully what you can also find in the book of Leviticus and elsewhere, that the guilt which came on the nation and the wrath of God could not be satisfied in any way but by a substitute, lest they themselves, well, the other way was that they themselves should perish. But if they were not to perish, the only way that this guilt could be turned away or God's wrath could be satisfied is that a substitute take their place. I don't know if maybe that's sort of obvious, especially if you've grown up in an evangelical church, but the church I was brought up in, you know, we were told, well, God doesn't need a sacrifice for sins, he just forgives people. You know, and there is no idea that there is a justice of God connected with the love of God, that the justice of God demands a sacrifice for sin. And that, I mean, that's written all over the Old Testament, it's written all over the New Testament, that there must be the shedding of blood if there is to be a remission of sins. And that's plain enough, I think, in what goes on here. And so there's a description then, as I said, I'll try to wrap this up fairly quickly and down to verse 24 of the offering that's made there. And a specific reference in verse 24 to the atonement for all Israel. And that idea of atonement then again emphasizes the substitutionary nature of the atonement, of the sacrifice, that it's paying the penalty for the sins of the nation. Then what follows in, well, let me see. Comments or questions? Ah, now, yeah. Mr. Carroll.
Do you think Israel here is to be understood in a wider context?
That's an interesting question. Especially the modern commentaries have picked up on the fact that, this may have been in the older ones too, but not as prominently, that the chronicler uses the phrase all in Israel in a deliberate way. And at this point, this is something I failed to say in the introduction, at this point the northern kingdom is no more as a kingdom. And so it would be particularly likely, I think, that this has to do with not only the southern kingdom, but also the remnant in the north. I think so, although I'm not sure I could defend it very carefully. It's interesting, that will become clearer when we go to chapter 30, because in chapter 30, Hezekiah sends out messengers to call the people of the north even back to this great celebration of the Passover. And so there particularly he has in mind his brothers in the north, and I think that may be what's going on here as well. It's hard to be dogmatic because the term Israel often refers, well, sometimes at least, refers to the southern kingdom by itself, and particularly after the fall of the northern kingdom it would. But I would tend to see it as including the northern kingdom. Okay, verses 25 then through 30, which is probably as far as we're going to get today, describe what is quite possibly parallel to what was going on in the verses preceding. That is, it could well be that he was describing in detail the sacrifices, and then now he's going to turn and describe the musical aspects of it. Obviously, in verses 25 through 30, the musical aspects are taking place simultaneously with the offering. And what I'm saying is that he may have given those details of the offering earlier. It's not completely clear. Now, this is one of the passages in Chronicles that gives quite a bit of information on how music was used in the worship of God. And in fact, it gives more detail probably than any other on the use of musical instruments. I mean, there's some setting out before of who was to do it and what the instruments were. But how it actually functioned is given in detail here with some other places that you could find in Chronicles. Again, the details may not be so interesting to us, that they had cymbals and stringed instruments and harps and so forth, and the placement of it may not seem particularly relevant. But the underlying principle the chronicler doesn't want us to miss, and I've already brought that out. It says, according to the commandment of David, but you have to keep reading. It was, of course, according to the commandment of David, because, as we already saw, David instituted the use of musical instruments on a much larger scale, certainly, than they had been before. They are hardly used at all before. It was under David that these things were introduced. But was it just David's idea, you might say? Well, it says, of Gad the king's seer, of Nathan the prophet, for thus was the commandment of the Lord by his prophets. So, as I said, there's an emphasis on worshiping according to God's will, but even down to the level of the use of the musical instruments, which was an innovation, you might say, of David, but it was a divinely given innovation. And so there's a description of how they stand, and they begin the offering, it says in verse 27, and when the burnt offering began, the song of the Lord also began, with the trumpets and the instruments of David, king of Israel. And so there was the singing until the burnt offering was finished, and then it says in verse 29, and when they had finished offering, the king and all who were present with him bowed and worshipped. And the king commanded the Levites to sing praise to the Lord. And with the words, notice the source of their words, their hymnal was the words of David and Asaph the seer, which of course is a reference to the psalms that were composed, as we saw, by the prophets God had set up, David and others. So that's referring back to 1 Chronicles 25 and elsewhere. So they sang praises with gladness, as we've already noted. It was a time of great rejoicing. Now, we shouldn't miss the fact that the king bows and worships, too. The king is under God. No surprise, although many of the kings either put themselves under other gods or set themselves up, at least to determine the worship of God. But there's an emphasis here, I think, that the king joined in the worship, and that's a helpful one to remember. Now, I'd like to reflect just a bit at the end here on the use of the musical instruments, because it is given a certain prominence here, and obviously there are questions that arise about the significance of the use of instruments. The connection with the sacrificial system is extremely plain here, right? It was when the sacrifice began that the musical instruments also began to be used, along with the singing. And it's because of that emphasis that the church in historically has understood that the musical instruments were connected with the ceremonial system and therefore passed away as the other elements of the ceremonial system passed away with the coming of Christ. Now, that idea, I think, is, again, the connection with the ceremonial system is plain enough, but exactly what the significance of the instruments were is maybe not completely clear, and there's some discussion. If you read the early church fathers, you find many developments of this theme that the musical instruments were there to represent various things. The joy of God's people, that they represented God's people themselves, so that we, as it were, play on musical instruments when we sing with our own voices to serve God. So there are a variety of interpretations of exactly the significance, even in the early church and their condemnation of the use of instruments, as well as in the time of the Reformation. What seems especially likely to me is the fact that the instruments were there to point to the tremendous joy of the sacrifice. I mean, I don't know about you, but it would be hard for me to really rejoice at seeing a lamb's throat slit and all the blood poured out, you know. It would be hard to get the connection between that and your salvation. And of course the law instructed them in that matter, but I think the point is that in their weakness they needed an additional emphasis that this was a time of great rejoicing, and so it seems likely that the musical instruments were there to amplify the joy which came with the sacrifices. That's a point which again you'd have to develop in the references to in the Psalms to the use of instruments and so forth, but I think it's interesting to think about the connection between the musical instruments and the worship of God, especially in song. You see, there's another question, that is, if this is the case, if this was so closely connected with worship, then isn't the singing also part of the ceremonial system? Right? That also was part of it, although it could well be that the verses that follow, verse 30 and following, describe singing apart from the sacrifice. It's not completely clear. Yet, there is a connection there. And this, again, is an issue which the early church and at the time of the Reformation was worked through, and a helpful distinction was made. Maybe a parallel would be to think about incense and prayer. The incense was there as a symbol closely connected with prayer. It was a complex symbol, but the incense itself, I think, pointed to the fact that our prayers rose before God, as well as the Book of Revelation brings in the fact that they are accepted before God because of a mediator, because of the sweet-smelling sacrifice of Christ. But just because the incense is done away in the New Testament doesn't mean prayer is done away, right? There is a typical element which accompanies a moral continuing element, and when the typical element passes away, the basic continuing aspect is continuing. Well, I think in a similar way you could argue that the musical instruments were there to accompany the singing, but as they were typical and pointed to the sacrifice, they pass away, although the singing continues. And I thought I would read a couple of quotations. They're a little bit long, but I thought you would find them interesting. One from the early church, which is making basically the same point, and one from the time of the Reformation. As I said, in both periods, both in the early church and in the time of the Reformation, there was a rejection of the use of musical instruments in singing. It was actually only very late in the Roman Catholic Church that instruments were introduced. Even Aquinas was opposed to the use of musical instruments, and he was fairly late in the corruption, time of corruption of the church. This is a quote from a fellow named Nikita, who was lived in the 5th century. And again, it's a little bit long. The book is on the utility of hymn singing, although don't be thrown off too much by the word hymn. It has a versatile use. But the point he's making is that we can still sing, but he brings in exactly this same emphasis. So this is what he says. It is time to turn to the New Testament to confirm what is said in the Old, and particularly to point out that the office of psalmody is not to be considered abolished merely because many other services of the old law have fallen into desuetude. They're not used anymore. Only the corporal institutions have been rejected, like circumcision, the Sabbaths, sacrifices, discrimination in foods. So too the trumpets, harps, cymbals, and timbals. For the sound of these, we now have a better substitute in the music of the mouths of men. The daily ablutions, the new moon observances, the careful inspection of leprosy are completely past and gone, along with whatever else was necessary only for a time, as it were for children. Of course, what was spiritual in the Old Testament, for example, faith, piety, prayer, fasting, patience, chastity, psalm singing, all this has been increased in the New Testament rather than diminished. So there he's making the argument that the obligation to sing praises to God is not so connected with the use of instruments that with the falling away of the use of instruments it should fail also. He emphasizes that's a spiritual work which continues. And then the other quote I thought I would read is it's written by Richard Mather, but this is the preface to what's usually called the Bay Psalm book. I don't know if you're aware of this, but the first book that was printed in the English colonies was a Psalter. And the Psalter is commonly called the Bay Psalm Book. The official title is The Whole Book of Psalms Faithfully Translated into English Meter. They had jazzier titles back then. But he actually talks about several different things here, and I don't think I'll read all of it, but let me pick up here. And the text is evident in Hezekiah's time. He's talking about our chapter. They are commanded to sing praise in the words of David and Asaph, 2 Chronicles 29:30, which one place may serve to resolve two of the questions, the first and the last, at once. For this commandment, was it ceremonial or moral, that is, to sing praises? Some things in it indeed were ceremonial, as their musical instruments and so forth. But what ceremony was there in singing praise with the words of David and Asaph? What if David was a type of Christ? Someone could bring forth that argument. Well, David was just a type of Christ. He says, was Asaph also? Was everything of David typical? Are his words, which are moral, universal, and perpetual authority in all nations and ages, are they typical? What type can be imagined in making use of his songs to praise the Lord? If they were typical because the ceremony of musical instruments was joined with them, then their prayers were also typical because they had that ceremony of incense and mixed with them. But we know that prayer then was a moral duty, notwithstanding the incense, and so singing these psalms, notwithstanding their musical instruments. Well, it's not my purpose to go into a detailed defense of singing, which I don't think is so much the question in our day. More the question in our day is whether musical instruments should still be used, and I don't intend to go into a detailed defense of that at this point either, but I hope at least you see the context of the church's historic rejection of the use of musical instruments as being connected with the ceremonial system. But that our argument doesn't apply to singing itself because it has a continuing moral authority. Maybe that's a lot to spring on you at the end. Any comments or questions? Bruce.
I was thinking that if we were to elect a president that was like a Hezekiah after the presidents they had their administration, who would he go to, or how would he do this similar type thing in our system? I mean, I'm trying to think.
Assistant,
you know how to hunt down the Reformed Presbyterian Church to get that right worship going again. Right.
Well, our system doesn't allow this kind of thing. It's unconstitutional. So. Any other questions? Now, so you should understand that he's functioning within a system where you had an established church, as it were. That is, that there was a well... I mean, that's part of the point of your question. I wasn't trying to be flippant. There was a well-recognized ecclesiastical and a unified ecclesiastical body. Whether it was faithful or not is another was the problem. But there was a well-identified group to whom he could call, and that was rejected at the founding of our nation. There was certainly still a desire to see Christianity flourish in the land, but they saw a different mechanism for doing that. So I don't know where son of President Clinton would turn. I doubt that he would look up the RP Church, but or that he necessarily should. But that it is a different system, and I'm not sure if that's what you're getting at. Maybe I should let you follow up your question.
I guess I'm just thinking in terms of we oftentimes appeal to God for revival or reformation. The appeal in some ways has to be on some covenantal grounds, but if the restoring of worship must precede reformation and the blessing of God, like we're seeing here, there's not even a mechanism for that.
Well, I wouldn't say there's not a mechanism. He already had part of it in the sense that there was already a covenantal structure, and so what was called on was a renewal of a covenant. I mean, historically, our church has pointed out that we need the institution of a covenant in the sense of an acknowledgement.
That might be the place that would start.
Well, yeah, except that of course. The situation is more complicated. If the hearts of God's people are not already prepared and moved in this direction, then such a covenant is pointless. I mean, it wouldn't go through anyway. But so it's difficult to take this model over to our current situation unless you have in mind especially the last verse of the chapter. It was God who really prepared the whole thing. And in our case, God would have different things to do. I mean, man's hearts are still corrupt, but the structures are not in place in the same way. So it would require, where Reformation always begins in the heart of God's people, and it would have to pass then to the churches. I think what we're seeing in Hezekiah's time was that God used a faithful ruler to call the churches to their duty. And that's, I think, the sort of thing you're getting at. In our situation, that there really is no structure for that. I mean, we're used to having our authorities tell us not to do our duty, whether directly or indirectly. So we tend not to listen, or hope we don't listen to what they say. But it would be difficult, I guess, I'm responding off the cuff, but it would be difficult to put the priority in quite the same place. I mean, the worship is still the priority, but the Hezekiah's action is the first thing. I guess it would be hard for me to see how to carry that forth. You have an idea?
No.
Okay.
It struck me as that one of the difficulties in looking from that angle to bring about a reformation of our country as this fundamental structural problem.
Yeah, that's right. Well, and that's part of what the RP Church's testimony for a long time, I think, is to point out the need for that structural change. Not necessarily the establishment of a church in the historical sense. I'm not saying that that's so explicit in our testimony, but the need for the recognition of a national covenant. Well, let's close in prayer.